Good evening, everybody. I'm Sean Bailey. I'm one of the producers of Tron Legacy and the president of production at Walt Disney Studios. Thank you. It's very nice to be here. And a big thank you to the Science and Entertainment Exchange for putting on this evening and also for their help with this movie, which we'll talk a little more about tonight. So to welcome our panel, we're going to have 20 to 30 minutes of discussion before we watch the movie. I'd like to welcome out my partner and I think a great new visionary on the movie making scene, the director of Tron Legacy, Joe Kaczynski. A gentleman who helped us early on with the movie, John Dick, physicist from JPL. And another great help and asset to us from Caltech, physicist Sean Carroll. So, to kick us off, this is an interesting movie to work on in that in 1982, Steven Lisberger imagined that human beings might one day go into digital systems, and he was exploring some really interesting questions about the interrelationship of biological life and digital life, and obviously predicted a world before we had computers on our desk, internet, cell phones, and now in a world of Facebook and Second Life, I think he made the science fiction movie of 1982 that much of it came true. So, Joe, in approaching this movie, how important was science and big conceptual ideas in reapproaching the title of Tron?
Well, I think it was important to us. Obviously, the concept as a whole is a little bit fantastical, but it was important to me and to you, and our other producer, Jeff Silver, that we have some sort of strong science foundation at each. Certainly those kind of key moments through the film. Particularly this idea of digitization and if it were possible to take some sort of organic matter or person and digitize them, how would you go about and do it? How could it be done? So we had this panel where we invited some of the smartest people we could find and asked them that very question and got some really interesting answers that we were able to actually incorporate into the film itself.
John and Sean, I'm really interested. We were talking a little bit backstage about kind of the overlap of what seems like pure creative movie making, whatever we can dream, and then actual scientific grounding, but also often scientific creativity leads to what we do, and I think sometimes perhaps entertainment, movie making leads to thought in what you folks do. How do you see that overlap? How important is it to be scientifically accurate in a movie versus just exploring an interesting idea? How do you see that that relationship?
I think it's very important. I mean, it's not scientists don't always get the right idea about what Hollywood should be doing in a movie like this. It's not a documentary. I've approached, talked to people in Hollywood, screenwriters, whatever, who literally recoiled in fear when they found out what I did for a living, a slight flinching, and that I was a scientist, because scientists, some of my best friends are scientists, but bless their hearts, they can be scolds. They can be killjoys. They can say, no, you can't do that. That's not fair. You can't have it that way. And that's not really what the scientific process is about. Scientists are also very good at saying, okay, if this is what happens, if these are your constraints, if this is what you want to have happen, what are the consequences of that? What other things are going to happen? What are the obstacles? How can you possibly overcome them? So I think that, facing with, if you want to make Tron, it's not helpful to have a scientist go, no, you can't put a human being inside a computer. But it is helpful to have a scientist go, well, what would that mean? How could we imagine it being possible in a consistent way that you're creating a world in which this does happen? And there are consequences of that in terms of how you get the person in the computer, what might happen when you're there. And I think that the creative give and take is actually really good for both sides.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I kept asking myself as we were called a year and a half ago to talk to you guys was what has changed in the science? Because you guys are in relationship to what's happened in the gaming world and all that sort of thing, in the look, the beautiful look of the new movie. But what's happened in science since that time, and one of the things that's happened in science since that time, is the creation of quantum computing and of quantum teleportation. And so we brought these ideas to the group, the producers. And quantum teleportation, the two ideas cut a couple of ways. One is, for the first time with those two ideas, it's now physically conceivable to actually take a particle in the real world and teleport it into a quantum computer. I mean, it disappears out here and it reappears in there. It can evolve, and then it could be re-teleported back into our world. So, as a proof of principle, you know, the guy, it's now we know how to think about how to do the whole process, not just the digital classical things, but we can do the quantum elements as well. And a second thing is that we have a process for the teleportation. And basically, one of the things that we talked about a little bit was the particle itself stays in this world. That is, every carbon and hydrogen and oxygen atom in your body stays in this world. But all of its information, including the classical and the quantum information, it's now conceivable to send into the computer and have it reside there.
We were talking a little bit, and I realize this conversation, I try to have this conversation without giving up any of the turns of the movie. I don't want it to become one big kind of spoiler. But we were talking a little bit back, we certainly deal with the idea in the movie of aspiration, sentience, you know, of these digital life forms. And John, you were talking a little bit about the idea of emergence, which I found pretty interesting, and I think kind of plays as a theme in the movie, if you talk a little bit about that.
This is one of the things I enjoy about a movie that puts out in a fundamentally, in a way that we can really grasp emotionally, ideas that are now accepted in the field of science. The idea of emergence is a new idea within the last 20 years. It's come forward. Which says that in complex systems or not so complex systems that behave in complex ways, there are behaviors that emerge that you could not have predicted. And so the ISO characters in both the first Tron and the Neutron are a wonderful example of this kind of thing, where you have created a world, and who knew?
Yeah, one thing, I question for you, Joe. You know, the kind of Venn diagram of science and creativity. Joe, you used a lot of new technologies and new scientific advancement in terms of movie making to achieve much of this movie. Can you talk a little bit about that, and also what that allowed you to do creatively in the movie?
Right.
That perhaps wasn't available to you creatively before these advancements were made.
Sure. Well, I think, you know, I think there's kind of three areas that we really kind of push the envelope in this film from a kind of technical point of view. The first, which wasn't really available when the first Tron was made, is this idea of 3D, being able to shoot a movie in 3D and present it in 3D. That's really only come around in the last few years, and, you know, with innovators like James Cameron really pushing the format has made it possible. So for this film, we created the latest version of the 3D camera based on what Cameron and Vince Pace developed for Avatar. It's called the Fusion camera system. And basically, it's two digital cameras strapped together. One's facing forward, and one's facing straight down. And there's an angled mirror called a beam splitter, that basically one camera is able to shoot through it to get the left eye, and the other camera is vertical and it's bouncing off that mirror to get the right eye. And the reason you do that is because you need to get those two points of view much closer than two cameras could ever get. So, you know, the human eye is an inch and a half or 2 inches apart. So in order to get two cameras that close, you need to use this beam splitter to get those two images. You're also doing something in this rig which we're probably not aware of in our own visual sight, but you can't have the cameras pointing parallel. Our eyes actually work by doing something called convergence, which means when you look at something, your eyes cross slightly to focus on something. So your eyes are always kind of pointed in, depending on how close that object is to your eyes. And if you don't do that with the 3D cameras, you can create an image that's very uncomfortable to look at. So you've also got these two cameras are on these controlled motors that allow them to do the same thing. You can converge them. You can also control the distance between them. So it's a very sophisticated rig that weighed about 150 pounds that we had to develop just for this film. So we use the latest generation Sony cameras, and then we put these giant lenses on them called Master Primes, which pull in this tremendous amount of light, which we needed to do for this movie because of the second technology we developed, which is fully illuminated suits. In the first Tron, the suits were all drawn by hand in order to make them look like they were lit up, but they were actually just black and white leotards on the first film. On our film, I really wanted the suits to actually emit light so that when two actors get near each other, you can see them illuminating each other, you can see them reflecting in each other's eyes. So we had to find a material that was flexible that could be fully illuminated, and we found this material called Polylite, which is a flexible fabric that runs on a 12-volt system, and we laid it through all the suits in this movie. So when you see them in the film, they're all actually emitting light, and all the suits have battery packs and inverters and remote controls and all this technology built into them so that they could work on camera. And then finally, the third technology, which is probably the most interesting, is this character of Clue in our film, who is the villain in the film, and it's played by Jeff Bridges, but it's actually Jeff Bridges, it's a fully digital version of Jeff Bridges at 35 years old. And that was based on some technology that won the Academy Award a few years ago for Benjamin Button. And that's a very sophisticated process where Jeff Bridges would play the role of Clue with a 4 HD cameras strapped to his head on a little helmet and all these dots on his face. His performance would be recorded, his facial performance would be recorded. Then we'd shoot the scene again with a body double playing the body of Clue with a head sock on. And then we would merge those two performances by mapping Jeff's performance onto a digital version of himself at 35 and then connect that head to the body of the second take. To create this character Clue. And I guess the reason that's really exciting is because we're able to tell a story that couldn't be told before. I think this is the first time that a actor has been able to play against himself at a younger age. And that's where the technology really, I think, blossoms in that you can use it to tell a new story rather than just using it for technology's sake.
It reminds me of one of my favorite quick anecdotes is when Steven Lisberger made the original Tron in 1982. The Academy, which obviously governs the Academy Awards, determined that he could not be nominated for best special effects in a movie because he had used computers, and using computers was deemed cheating, which I always really liked. We had the great benefit, thanks to the Science Entertainment Exchange, of sitting down with these folks before. We went to shoot the movie, and I think you'll see, and I hope you'll feel a lot of the outcome of the conversation in the movie. But Sean, you were there, and maybe could you talk a little bit about that conversation and some of the ideas at play and some of the places we went?
Yeah, that conversation was when there's already a script for the movie, so we were not imagining what the movie was going to be about, and it was a sequel to Tron, so we knew what it would be about. But you really want to construct the whole world. You want to know the answers to questions that aren't necessarily discussed explicitly during the movie. So we had a wide-ranging discussion of what it would mean to digitize a person and to put them into the computer, what it means for computer programs to become intelligent all on their own. In fact, there's a scene near the beginning where the Alan Bradley character spouts what sounds like a little bit of technobabble. He mentions genetic algorithms and quantum teleportation, and you're sitting there going, yeah, all right, I get it, futuristic, science-y. But those are actually very crucial ideas in how the movie works. Genetic algorithms are a big part of programs writing themselves, programs learning and changing and going beyond what their programmers aspired to do. And that was not something that was current in the early 1980s. It's something we know about now, and it's a crucial part of what happens in the movie. The quantum teleportation, as John mentioned, we can imagine what it would mean to take a person with a laser beam, digitize them, and put them in this completely silicon substrate. And my favorite thing I only learned recently, if you walk outside here and look at the prop, we had the laser out here that was used to zap sampling into the computer. And there are these tubes next to the lasers. And what are these tubes? Well, there's something called conservation of mass. So if you take someone and you zap them with a laser and you put their information into the computer, you still have all of their atoms lying around. And if you want to get them back out, you need more atoms to make them out of. So these tubes contain the oxygen and the carbon and all the raw materials you need to make a human being. And you would not even notice that. If you wouldn't need to notice it. You can turn that part of your brain off while you watch the movie and just enjoy the ride. But if you want to think about what is going on, there's a lot there to think about. And I like to think that the input from the scientists helped tell sort of a richer, more consistent story.
I think it certainly did. And I think that Joe is a very specific filmmaker, and we had a screening I was mentioning to John and Sean recently. We've invited most of the Facebook programmers, and very early there's a hack, and I believe it's Unix, right? There's a hack, and it's Unix code, and it was, I think, the only screening where we ever got a big laugh off the Unix hack. Let's talk, John and Sean, I want to ask you for a minute about, let's talk movie ethics, which I know sounds like a big oxymoron. Do we have an obligation in the movie business to get it right scientifically? Where do you think that line sits? And when can it be broken and when shouldn't it be broken?
There's an interesting observation, which is that the idea of quantum teleportation was, in fact, the first paper was published in 1993. It almost gets there with the timeline of the movie, which says 20 years before. And it certainly doesn't get there from the original Tron, but this movie takes place 20. But so it's almost there. But it's interesting how that's a close. But I'm willing to give it the nod.
Yeah, I think if you're asking, do movies have an obligation to get the science right? I mean, my friends are not going to like this, but the answer is no. Movies have an obligation to make a good movie. And I think that if scientists go into movies hoping that it's going to be a nice little explication of the laws of physics, they're not in the right place. There's other places you can get that. But on the other hand, to make a good movie, it helps to get the science right, just as it helps to get anything right. And even if it's subconscious, if something that goes on in a movie doesn't make sense, if you're wondering, you know, why is it that way rather than the other way, just sitting there in the audience, that deteriorates the experience of the movie. And by thinking like a scientist and understanding what the laws of nature are, even if they're not the nature that we know and love, but they're the nature of the movie, it makes you tell a more consistent story. It might even raise problems. I did a consult where someone was writing a movie, and they said, well, so we have this character who's like the smartest person in the world. He's just like Einstein, and he builds this wonderful machine. And I said, you know, Einstein didn't build any machines because he was a theoretical physicist, and theoretical physicists don't build machines. Maybe he has a friend. And so actually that makes the movie better. They're like, yes, he has a friend, and his friend is a wonderful sort of technical person, an engineer, and can build things, but then there's tension because the friend doesn't like the machine he's building and so on. And so I think that almost without exception, the one exception is if scientists tell you, if you're making like a cop show, and the scientists tell you the DNA results take 2 weeks to come back, they can't get them the next day, you should just ignore them then. But under almost any other circumstances, if the scientist is helping understand the consequences of the laws, the rules of the game, then it's not that the movie is trying to get science right for its own sake, it's that working, thinking like a scientist makes the movie better.
I have a question for Joe.
Yeah.
I was wondering if your mindset was with regard to possibly changing the laws of our world, the physical laws having to do with the dynamics, say, of cycle motion and that sort of thing in the computer world.
Well, for this movie, I liked my idea or thought for the world of Tron was that this simulation, this Tron simulation that's been running on this server for 20 years is constantly refining itself and trying to replicate the real world. So it's trying to become more real. There are now weather simulations. There is a gravity simulation. There's momentum. There's inertia. There's damage when things hit each other. So the idea is that this world is very realistic because it's evolved that way. I kind of saw it as like this Galapagos Islands that's constantly refining and evolving. So I tried to use as many real-world physical laws in this world as possible, because I felt like if we did that, then the movie, then the world would feel real, and then hopefully the drama would feel real as well.
Yes, I certainly had noticed the difference from the old 1980s computer game
certainly,
motion
yeah.
of,
yeah,
of well, the early Tron.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at video, you know, the video games I grew up on in the arcades of the 1980s, and then
yes.
compare them to, you know, like one of, you know, like Gran Turismo 5 or something, you'll see that the level of simulation that's going on in games today is pretty amazing.
And Joe, you know, in weighing the science of all of this, you know, were there moments where you felt the science had to be bent to fit the story, or the story had to be bent to fit the science? And how important was that connection to you in terms of going through this narrative?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I never wanted to feel like we were a slave to it. I mean, obviously, as you were saying, the first goal is to create a great movie and tell a great story. So that's got to be your kind of priority one while making it. But I do think, you know, based on that meeting that we had, I feel like we actually, through that discussion, we were able to kind of improve parts of the story. And it wasn't so much a hindrance, but it actually gave us ideas, I think, to some other storylines, and this idea of emergence, and obviously keyed into a big idea in the film, which is, I think, one of our most exciting ideas. So I never felt hindered by it. I think it always served as kind of a springboard into some of our better things.
And John and Sean, without kind of giving up any specific plot turns, if everyone kind of had a scientist on their shoulder watching this
movie. I like
movie,
that idea.
It's good for business.
24/7.
Good for business. What are some of the ideas? We've covered a few of them, but what are things to watch for and perhaps think about from your guys' perspective, who kind of knew them a little bit of the movie before we shot it, have seen it since? What do you think of things to pay attention to?
Well, you know, we're jaded because of the original Tron and because of all the movies that came after that. But the idea that you can take a person and put them in a computer is kind of an amazing idea, and not at all clear even today that it's true, even in principle, right? I mean, people talk about, is consciousness the same if it's in a human brain versus if it's in a computer or something like that? So not just getting them there, but is it even sensible to contemplate taking a human being, uploading them into the matrix, then having them do things? You know, every scene in the grid here is a metaphor, right? There's not a box where there's little people riding light cycles around. There's a computer program chasing around. And I think that, you know, one thing just to think about is, what does that mean? You know, here are computer programs with personalities, with aspirations, hopes, and dreams. If you did get uploaded in a computer, would you be the same person, or would you be different? If I don't want to give away too much away, so I'll stop there.
John, anything to add to
that? I don't really have any additional comments, I don't think. You've done it, I think. Thank you.
Like spoke first. Yeah.
Yeah. Joe, you made a decision fairly early on about scientific reference once we were inside the world and the laws once we were inside of it. The first movie spent a lot of time kind of explaining what was an accounting program and what was storage and what was... Can you speak a little bit about your thinking on kind of specific scientific reference inside the grid and why that was?
Well, I don't think either you or I were interested in making a movie about technology directly. So once you get into the world of Tron, you're not going to hear anything about gigabytes or Twitter or Google. This isn't an internet movie. The way that we kind of talk about technology is through the relationship of the characters in the film, which I think is much more interesting. So We specifically didn't want to make this, we didn't want to have any kind of technology or scientific terms kind of said by the characters on the inside. Once you get inside the computer, you know, I think the idea is we thought of it more as a Western. You know, it felt like you were just in another world, and it had its set of rules, but this, what, you weren't aware constantly that you were inside the world of a computer. And you know, I think the big reason for that is we knew that any kind of technology jargon we'd be throwing around would be dated 5 years from now, and that's just the way technology works. It's always changing, always evolving, and you can be, you know, behind the times before you know it. So we chose to avoid that and hopefully make a movie that, you know, is about technology in a more thematic sense, and 10 years from now still is something you can sit down and watch.
That is another thing, if you're asking for the audience to keep track of, is there are the laws of physics in the grid in that world are not the same as our laws of physics. And they're subtly different. You know, the simulation capability is enough that they're much more realistic than they were for the original. But you can see scenes, you will notice scenes where you're like, you know, that can't really happen in the real world because of the laws of physics. And it's interesting because given that it's a complete simulation, the laws of physics could be anything. There's no reason for space to be three-dimensional in the grid, right? There's no reason that it takes time to go from one place to another. But this is not any old simulation. This is a simulation built by a human being, right? Built originally by a programmer. Like you say, it's isolated from the rest of the world. There's a limitation of imagination, or maybe a limitation of what you would like it to look like. So this is a simulation. It's not the real laws of physics, but it's in a person's image, or at least in the image of what's in their mind.
And it also needs to grip us as we watch it.
We need to relate to it. Right?
We need to relate to it as we watch it. And that brings another thought to mind. You know, as you're asking, should people be thinking about the science? And I'd say, good luck. It's such a visually stunning movie. It's hard to keep your thinking cap on during the course of it.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting in that Joe, I mean, the actual kind of physical property in the world, in fact, to speaking to what I think Sean was speaking about earlier, but even subconscious cues of, you know, the way the camera would move when something blows by it, or what we can intuit as human beings, you wanted to bring a real photographed sense to this world. Could you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to feel like we took, you know, all of our equipment and we digitized our crew and went in and shot this thing from the inside. So it had to feel real. It had to feel photographed. And to me, that would make it feel like, you know, that's what helps transport the audience, is if you feel the buffeting of the wind when you're free falling, or you feel, you know, the camera does shake when a light runner goes by at 140 miles an hour. That's the kind of stuff you have to add to just make it feel real and make that jeopardy feel real.
And to follow up on that, this movie is obviously about a world of one man, Kevin Flynn, played by Jeff Bridges, design. What kind of design challenge, thrill was, you know, to build and conceive an entire world from the mind of one man? I mean, I guess, probably a nice ego. I mean, yeah. you kind of got to be the Kevin Flynn of the movie, I guess.
I did, yeah. Certainly that was one of the things that really excited me about the project when we first started talking about it is, you know, usually in these science fiction movies or any movie, the world itself is a hodgepodge of things. It's, you know, a cityscape will be 1,000 skyscrapers or buildings, each designed by someone different. But one thing I really liked about the world of Tron is it really is all the creation of one man, Kevin Flynn. So the architecture and the costumes or the characters and the vehicles, the city plan, everything had to feel like it came from one mind. So there's a cohesiveness to the world across everything that you just really can't justify in any other movie except for Tron. So for me, that was a really exciting challenge. My background is in design, and my production designer went to Art Center in Pasadena. He's learned automobile design. So it was fun for us to assemble this incredible crew of the best designers that we could find in the world and gather them all together in our art department, you know, 40 or 50 people, and really get this entire group of people with all these different talents and aesthetics to start behaving like one man and start designing like one, you know, like one person would. And it took a few months, but after a while, the drawings coming out, we couldn't tell who did what anymore. There was a consistency across all the work that was it was really beautiful, and that results in, you know, the world that you see on screen.
Last couple questions, and then we'll roll the movie for Sean and for John. What movies do you think were the most relevant, interesting, important to the scientific community?
You go first.
Oh, my. Well,
or do you personally, if that's an easier way to phrase the question.
Well, that's 2001, I suppose.
2001, Contact is another one. Yeah. You know, Carl Sagan wrote the
original
script. And,
you know, 2001, I know Stanley Kubrick hired real NASA engineers to work on that movie. Like, those were not, he didn't want any Hollywood concept designers working on it. It was all real engineers and stuff on that. Mm-hmm.
And I'll give a shout out while we're here to The Big Bang Theory on TV right now. Our friend, it's has the most accurate physics of any show on TV, because our friend David Salzberg is in the audience tonight, is the full-time science advisor.
Well done, David.
And he reads every script, and, you know, the equations on the whiteboards are right. And it's also the most popular comedy on TV. Coincidence? I don't think so.
Very good. And to that point, so we can all succeed more, what do you think, how do you think we work together better? How do these two communities, what else can these two communities be doing to work more closely together going forward?
I don't think that every movie needs a science advisor. I don't think that every scientist needs to talk to Hollywood. There's people I want to keep away. But, you know, if you get people with the right attitude, on both sides, you know, from the entertainment side, the attitude is, let's try to make a consistent, coherent set of rules, a laws of physics for this world, whatever it is, and what can you tell me about how that might work? And you bring together scientists who are like, okay, it doesn't have to be a documentary, it doesn't have to send off the message that scientists are all brilliant and ethical and ruggedly handsome, but instead we can create something that, you know, one of the best phone calls I ever had from the Science and Entertainment Exchange was, I won't tell you what movie because I never know what to give away, but they said, okay, we're really, really embarrassed to ask you this because we know you're a serious scientist and you deal with equations and everything, but what we need is a grand unified theory of magic. And I was like, awesome, that is the best request I've ever had, because you get to start from scratch. You get to build a world all by yourself. And I think what's going to happen, the Science Entertainment Exchange being the best example of it. Actually, the best example of it is that we have Joe Kosinski and Sean Bailey here to talk about not just the movie, but the science of the movie, which is a great testament, I think, to how important it is. But it will become sort of just accepted that, of course, if you have a movie that has scientific themes in it, it will be better if you bring scientists in and hear what they have to say right from the start.
And we naturally think of medical shows having a medical advisor, so that certainly makes sense for a science show. This is my first experience as a scientist with a movie, and it was interesting to walk into that room with you guys the first time with everything up for grabs. You know, nobody knew what might come out of it, and we chatted for half an hour, and some ideas came out, and it's been lovely to see you guys pick up on them.
Great. They were very valuable to us, and I can say personally, one of the great thrills of this job is the ability to meet and, you know, learn this much about all kinds of really fascinating facets of life and different professions and all that. So before we start, Joe, are there any last thoughts before we roll the movie?
My only thought would be, you people on the sides, try to find a seat closer to the center. Because 3D works best when you're looking for it. So I'm just thinking for you people on the very edges there.
He's laying some science.
And over there.
I really want to be.
Great. Well, I thank you all very much for being here. We really, really hope you enjoy the movie. I'd like to thank Sean Carroll, John Dick, Joe Kosinski. Thanks to Science Entertainment Exchange for having us. Hope you have a good night. I think they'll clear these. I think we can just exit.